And so we're constantly bombarded with lots of different types of information all the time. And some of it will be positive, some will be negative. We can always find the negative in any situation. But when you're prone to depression, those are the things that you notice.
Hi there, I'm Alex von Klimper and this is Cortex Cast, the podcast bringing you discussions with some of the most interesting researchers in neuroscience today. We'll be exploring the full spectrum of neuroscience, from cognitive behavioral research to cutting-edge molecular and transgenic techniques. We also want to explore how these researchers think about the brain and what really drives them to ask the questions that they do. If you're interested in Cortex, then this is the cast for you. Cortex Cast is the official podcast of the Cortex Club, an Oxford University student-run society which connects Oxford students and researchers with world-leading neuroscientists. Researchers are provided a forum ranging from small, intense debates to large discussion sessions, usually followed by drinks with the students at the pub. If you'd like to know more about Cortex Club, including some of our past speakers, you can head to our website, cortexclub.com. Before we jump into it, I'd like to just ask the following. If you like what we're doing here, please subscribe or like this episode or leave a comment. If you love the show, tell us what you love about it. And if it isn't working for you, then let us know what you really didn't like about it.
I'm Paula Kanders, and in this episode, Lucas and I meet up with Catherine Harmer, professor at the Department of Psychiatry here in Oxford. She heads the Psychopharmacology and Emotional Research Lab, which studies the effects of psychiatric treatments, such as antidepressants, on emotional information processing. Catherine approaches this research question from many different angles, including neuropsychology, neuroimaging, and collaborations with psychiatrists in the clinic. As such, she is in a great position to comment on the state of the art in psychiatry, both as a scientific field and an applied field of medicine.
Okay, Catherine, thanks so much for joining us on our podcast. We always like to start by asking our interviewee what got them interested in science. So have you always had a fascination for science and research?
Well, yes, I was always interested in science, even at school, and I did biology A-level. But I wasn't a complete scientist because I also studied English literature and economics. And so it's a sort of real mixture. But I was always really interested in psychology and the kinds of questions that psychologists deal with.
You had this interest, but how did you sort of like get into the work that you do right now specifically?
Well, it was a long process, I suppose. So when I was an A-level student, I was particularly interested in psychology and the kinds of issues that were around at that time. So this is a long time ago. So we were still debating kind of nature versus nurture. Mm. And there was a lot of work on hot housing and intelligence. And this was during my adolescence. And I was really interested in how the brain could be so plastic and actually change with the environment so much. So I was really fascinated in those kinds of questions. And that led me to reading a little bit around psychology. And then I did a psychology degree. And it was only when I was doing my psychology degree that I became more and more interested in the science part, and particularly the neuroscience part and how the brain actually works. And once that was touched upon, I was really fascinated by it. And I sort of pursued it bit by bit. I did my research project on how to modify cognitive function with ginseng. And which I guess laid the foundation for my interest in medicine and psychiatry and linking that with what we understand about the brain and about cognition in general. And so, yes, that was the start. And then to come here in Oxford and work in psychiatry was a longer journey in that I did a PhD in psychopharmacology using animal models of drug addiction. And I was really interested in that, but I really wanted to work closer to the more applied side, so working with patients, with humans, with clinical questions, closer to translating science into practice. And so that led me to apply here as a postdoc working in psychiatry, and I've been here ever since.
So you just mentioned that you worked on drug addiction. Now you have your own research group, and as far as I understand, your research focuses very much on the topic of depression. And I'm curious to find out what actually got you interested in this very clinical topic.
Yes, it's always hard to look back and realise what made you interested in something, because there's so many small decisions that you make along the way. I think I was always interested in how the brain works, and particularly how treatments that we may take for a variety of different reasons may change the brain. And of course, the largest application of that is in psychiatry, where we have disorders spanning across depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, which are largely treated with a range of medication. And I was really interested in how these medications actually worked, given that most of these treatments were discovered by chance along the way. And at the time that they were discovered, no one really knew how they worked. And even now, we're not 100% sure of how they work. And so it just seems such an interesting and important challenge. If we want to make a difference to mental health, and we want to create new treatments, or we want to use the treatments that we have in a better way, then we need to understand how they're working and who they work for. And I think it was the combination of all of that that was particularly interesting and raised some fascinating questions that I wanted to look at.
So let's get into sort of your work now a little bit. Can you sort of walk us through the different ways, the different methods that you use to study these drug effects?
Yes, so I work entirely in humans myself in this group, although we collaborate with other groups. And we broadly take what's called an experimental medicine perspective, which means rather than looking at whether a treatment works, or the large scale randomised clinical trial, we try and understand the mechanisms by which they may work in a lab-based setting. And so we particularly focus on how antidepressants affect how we deal with emotions and emotional processing, which is a key fundamental process that can be affected in things like depression and anxiety. And so in a typical study, we would test the effect of an antidepressant, or maybe an unknown drug that we think might be an antidepressant, compared to a sham or a placebo. And we would give that to either healthy people, first of all, probably to get an idea of how the drug's working, and then later in depressed patients. And then we would look at the effects, not on whether people felt better, but how they recognise facial expressions of emotion, how their brain responded to emotional stimuli, how they make decisions about reward versus loss, all of these kinds of processes that are related to depression, but not just how you describe them, it's actually how you react to things and pick up on things and remember things we're not really aware of what we're doing all the time.
So you use a number of psychological tests to assess emotion processing in healthy volunteers and patients. Yes. Your group also uses brain imaging techniques.
Yes.
So would you mind to elaborate how these brain imaging techniques can actually help us to understand the healthy and the depressed brain?
Yeah, so we particularly used fMRI to look at how the brain is responding, say, to these emotional cues or information. And we use that as a way in to understand what might happen in depression, how the brain can lead to some of these experiences of very low mood and loss of pleasure and other symptoms of depression. And then how antidepressant drug treatments interface with those same systems, perhaps to change the balance of this processing. And so when people are depressed, there's evidence that they particularly focus on and remember more negative information. And so we're constantly bombarded with lots of different types of information all the time. And some of it will be positive, some will be negative. We can always find a negative in any situation. But when you're prone to depression, those are the things that you notice, and those are the things that you interpret, and those are the things you lay down in your memory. And so given exactly the same situation, exactly the same stress, or exactly the same social interaction, if you're vulnerable to depression, you may pick up on those things more. And so that gives us a way of using fMRI to try and understand what is it in the brain that makes people
react more to negative over positive? How does the brain prioritize these different streams of information and decide what's most important to process on and look at? So we use this as a way of understanding what might go wrong in depression, but then also how antidepressants might start to shift it. So antidepressants in particular seem to redress that balance, so they allow individuals to pick up more on positive cues and to ignore some of the negative cues. And they do that even when you're not aware of it and even before you start to feel better. And we can see those effects in the brain as well with fMRI, particularly how, for example, areas like the amygdala react to positive and negative emotional information.
It's very fascinating. So are we at a point where we can already use brain imaging as a biomarker for depression?
No, not yet. I mean, there's been a huge amount of progress in the field of looking for biomarkers for depression and looking for biomarkers of treatment. I have to say that the biomarker for depression is a harder task than as a biomarker for treatment. And that's because probably depression as a package is not one thing. And so these diagnostic categories that we have are not based on biology. And so if we look at things like depression, we see huge variability between different individuals. And so there is no one ground truth for diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So the brain imaging could maybe help diagnose a subtype or a subprocess in depression, but I can't see how we're going to make it map onto the diagnostic category very well. But there is increasing evidence that you can use some aspects of brain imaging to indicate whether an individual is likely to respond to a particular type of treatment or whether they currently are responding. And I think that's a tighter comparison because you're looking within an individual rather than as across a diagnostic category. So the field is very, very focused on that question of biomarkers. We're not there yet, but every year I think we're getting a bit closer.
So what changes in the brain function of a depressed patient when you apply one dose of an antidepressant? What kind of early signs of a positive change can you pick up in your brain scans?
Yeah, so the brain scans and also the behaviour pick up changes that people can't describe at a conscious level. And so what we see is very early changes in networks of areas involving, say, the amygdala and parts of the prefrontal cortex. And so in a typical fMRI task, we would present, say, fearful, sad facial expressions and happy facial expressions. And what you see in depressed patients is that there's a greater response and activation of areas like the amygdala to the negative face compared to the positive face. And when you give an antidepressant, you see exactly the opposite. Suddenly now the positive face attracts all the attention, it gets all the activation, it gets all the salience and the interest. And so you can see those changes even after one dose. And actually you can see them even in healthy participants. So even people without depression will start to respond more to positive stimuli when they've had just one dose of antidepressant.
So faces are kind of your main type of stimulus that you use to look at emotional processing.
Yes.
What's so special about faces and why do you use them to study depression?
Yes, we have a lot of our tasks do use faces, not entirely. So we do use some word stimuli and some reward stimuli as well. But I think faces are really, really good cue because they're so important to humans. They're important right from birth all the way through our life. And there's a lot of research which suggests that there are these fundamental facial expressions that are seen across all cultures, across all areas of people that have been tested. And so they are almost an innate kind of form of communication, which we all recognise and understand. And we're very sensitive to that as humans. So we can pick up even very subtle faces or emotions in other people. And we use them to guide our own behaviour and our own emotional response to that, even, again, outside of conscious awareness. We're not aware that we're doing it, but we're picking up and monitoring facial expressions all the time. But there's also evidence that that's the process that can go wrong in depression. So this negative bias of seeing faces as more negative can have quite a big impact on social function and social interaction. So one of our tasks, we have these different levels of different faces, and if we give a very low level of a happy face very ambiguous, but just subtly happy. A healthy person would think that that was a happy face, and a depressed patient would often mistake that for disgust or anger. So a very negative face. And you can imagine that if you're in a situation where you're seeing other people as disgusted or angry with you, you will behave differently yourself. And so it can build up this difficulty that can then compound the problems of depression. You might start avoiding people or withdrawing away, feeling a lot of negative thoughts about yourself. And it can be partly based on this misperception of what other people are thinking and feeling. So it's such an important way in for humans and such an important part of social function and such an important thing for depression. And it gives us an idea of what's happening in the brain generally. Probably it's not unique to faces. It's probably just a very neat way of picking up these cues because we're so good at looking at faces. Whereas words can mean different things to different people, and they're certainly different across cultures, so it makes it a bit more difficult to translate it into other languages.
CorticsCast is only made possible through the generous support of the British Neuroscience Association. We are also supported by Oxford Neuroscience Departments. To find out more about our sponsors, including the full list of Oxford academic departments which support our work, check out our website at corticsclub.com.
So just to take like a small step back, so you already mentioned you think of depression as people interpreting the same information differently. Is that kind of like your theory of depression, like the way that you think about it when you design experiments?
It's partly the way I think about it. I mean, I think it would be an oversimplification to say that all of depression could be based on that, but it is one of the processes that I think is involved in depression. And perhaps I would even go further for some people, given that what we're saying, that depression is, it's not a uniform diagnosis. But I think it is an important, this negative bias is an important process in depression. And when we're designing an experiment, we will have that framework in mind. When you're looking at brain data or behaviour, you need something, kind of key to unlock it, because if you just look at the brain and you're not really sure where to look or what you're looking for, it can be very confusing. So it's one way of opening the door, but it's not the only way. And we and other people are also very interested in other facets of depression, and I mentioned one briefly, which is more to do with how you think about or how you look forward to rewards and pleasurable activities, which is also a really important component of depression, where things that you may have enjoyed in the past, suddenly you're not so interested in them and you can't really see what you saw in them before. And that can change your, but have a huge impact on your behaviour. So I think that there's always a framework for thinking about depression, the effects of treatment. But it would be a simplification to say that is the only thing. But as scientists, we need to have a framework to start with, I think.
So you were saying that depression is an extremely complex and complex disorder, which can have many very different expressions. So taking this into account, I think a lot of people have criticized the research on animal models for depression, saying that it's very difficult to capture this disorder in an animal model. Now, you are in the unique position of having experience with both, with animal research and human research.
Yeah.
Do you think there's any value in studying a complex disorder like depression in animal models? And if so, what are the things that we can learn from animal models which we can't learn from research in humans?
Yeah, I think there's advantages and disadvantages of the different approaches, and it's hard, and we need both. I think we do need both, and they fulfill different roles. And so with animal models, of course, you have much more precision of what you're looking at and how you can manipulate the brain and what you can measure. So if you're actually interested in a specific circuit or in firing patterns or the involvement of a specific receptor in a specific part of the brain, you have to use an animal model. At the same time, you have to recognize that, like you said, it's really difficult to model all of depression in an animal in an animal model, and you don't really know for sure if what you're modeling is be saying, because you can't use language to find out. But I think there's different ways in which you can use animal models. You can use them as a pure mechanistic models to understand how brain circuits, for example, interact and how they function and how different treatments might affect those dynamics. And then you can model various aspects of behaviour that may be relevant to the experience of depression, bearing in mind that you'll only be modelling an aspect of behaviour. So many of the animal models actually look at anxiety phenotype, so how nervous the animal is. That's an important component, but it's not the only component. And then others will look at whether they like to drink sucrose as a model of anhedonia, which again is one component. And then perhaps some of the newer animal models look at memory biases and emotional biases, which I think get a bit closer to how the experience is in depression. So I think we have to make sure that we're talking to each other, these different groups of researchers, so we can learn the questions to translate to humans, and equally they can take findings from us and then drill down into them and understand the mechanisms. But the animal work is often the very first stage of finding a new treatment. So for example, there's really beautiful work in animal models showing, for example, that one serotonin receptor subtype might be important in depression, which is the 5-HT4 receptor. And really, really lovely work going from electrophysiology through to behavioural models of depression, which suggests that it may be a promising compound. But until recently, no one had tested that in humans because there wasn't any compounds that specifically affected that receptor. But now we just started a programme of work looking at new treatments which do affect that receptor, and we don't know yet if the findings from the animal work will translate, but that is the way in which these new treatments start off, usually, that there's some clue from animal models that then we need to test in humans. There's often a big gap between that. It doesn't always translate, but this is quite interesting. We're just lucky that there happens to have been a drug that was licensed actually for the treatment of constipation that does affect these, is a 5-HT4 partial agonist and gets into the brain. So it's kind of lucky break for us that we can actually for the first time look at that in humans.
Right, so you kind of go from sort of finding something in an animal, seeing if you can find something similar in humans, and then how do you collaborate with clinicians, like people in the clinic? Are there sort of concrete ways in which your research can affect current treatments of people with depression?
There are. I mean, it depends a bit on what you found and how you... But we have a vehicle for that, which is funded by the NIHR, the Biomedical Research Centre here, which is about taking these experimental medicine findings and then applying them in finding a way to influence clinical practice. And so the bit of my work is sort of sits in between. So it feeds on from preclinical animal work, understands the mechanisms, finds the most promising agents, and then passes them on to the clinical testing. And we have a very strong clinical research facility here who runs those kinds of trials, led by some of the psychiatrists here. So we are in quite a good position to take those early findings all the way through to the clinic. But there can be lots of ways in which the findings can influence the clinic, actually. So it might be a new treatment, like in that example, but it might be, as you mentioned before, having some kind of biomarker that might refine the prescribing of treatments. Mm-hmm. And that we need to test out in the clinic. And so then we have to set up those collaborations and try putting the biomarker in the clinic and seeing if we can use that information to, for example, pick up people who are not responding to treatments earlier. So yes, we're lucky here that we're in a really good situation, that we've got excellent preclinical work in the science area, and then we've got the excellent clinical practice and service here, and then we've got the bit in the middle, which is, fine.
Yeah, right. I guess neuroscientists tend to sort of study patients for two reasons, right? And I feel like one that we've talked about quite a lot is sort of how to assess treatments and get some sort of mechanistic perspective of what they're actually doing. But one other view might be is that you could use a system when it breaks down to understand it, right? So like, do you feel that your work is also contributing to understanding emotional processing itself aside from depression?
Yes, I think as you alluded to, the work is very much situated in that applied space. It's, the questions are really about how treatments work and what goes wrong in depression. But to do that, you really need to understand how emotional processing is working and how different facets of cognition are working. And you and the two go in tandem. So we would hope that some of these observations actually tell us a bit about how the brain is organised, how we normally deal with this different kind of information. How does the brain know which type of information to prioritise, and when does it switch between positive and negative, and how does that actually work in practice? And these are all kinds of questions that you think that we might know, but actually we don't really. There's still a lot about basic brain function in this area to understand.
Yeah, there are many open questions in depression research, yeah, as far as I understand, and some of your earlier work actually addressed and provided one possible answer to the long-standing questions why antidepressants actually have this delayed effect. Would you mind to tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so that was interesting because everyone knows that you need to take antidepressants for quite a few weeks before you start to change the symptoms of depression. So research very much focused on changes that occurred in the brain with that same delay. Almost as if you need have a change in the brain and then immediately you feel better. And so there was a lot of emphasis on changes in, say, receptor sensitivity or changes in neuroplasticity or growth of new neurons, and trying to pinpoint exactly what happened in the brain after 3 or 4 weeks and then how that led to depression. But what we did is instead we looked very early on after antidepressants, even after one dose, and found that antidepressants affected these emotional processes very, very early on, surprisingly early. And so you just have one dose of an antidepressant, within hours you're picking up more positive cues and less negative. And so that gives us a very psychological explanation for the delay in the clinical effects of antidepressants, because it suggests that antidepressants, they're not mood enhancers. They don't immediately make you feel better. What they do is they're more information processing modulators. So they change how you're dealing with information, but that won't immediately make you feel better either, because you need those experiences to benefit from that perspective. So you need to be in your social and emotional world, and gradually you're picking up very subtle increases in positive emotion. Then over time, you can learn from that and you'll modify your own behaviour and there'll be changes that accrue. So it's quite a different take on how antidepressants work, because it says they are working straight away, but you don't really notice the effects for 3 or 4 weeks, rather than they're not doing anything, then boom, something changes and you feel better. It's a different, a more psychological perspective.
So speaking about possibilities for the future, there's a lot of media attention and excitement about rapid acting antidepressants at the moment.
Yes.
Would you mind to explain us a little bit about this, how they act and what their potential additional benefits might be?
Yes.
In addition to the current treatments we have.
Yes, I mean, it's a really exciting area of development right now. As you say, we've all got used to this sort of assumption that antidepressants take weeks and weeks to work, and that's how antidepressants work. And then suddenly there seems to be these new wave of compounds that actually do work much more quickly. And they, at least at the neurochemical level, they seem to work. There's a range of different options. So there's drugs like ketamine, which is a glutamate modulator, amongst other effects it has, and psilocybin, even LSD being considered as potential antidepressants. And these treatments seem to resolve some of the symptoms of depression very, very, very quickly, within hours, so you don't need that long delay. No one really knows at a kind of cognitive neuroscience level what's happening and how these treatments might be working. But we have got a research program on ketamine. Ketamine's probably got the most evidence-based as this rapid antidepressant action. And there's a ketamine clinic here in the Wandford for treatment-resistant depression. But there is some animal work which suggests that drugs like ketamine don't affect so much how you deal with incoming information. So they don't really change how you store memories in the first place, which SSRIs seem to, but instead they change how you retrieve them. So you end up retrieving your memories, which is a fragile process anyway. We can all retrieve memories in different mood states and think about things that have happened to us in a completely different way. But what seems to happen is, in the animal model, but if you retrieve a memory, under ketamine, it becomes more positive, less negative. And so that gives one potential explanation for how the drugs might work a bit more quickly, because in that case, you wouldn't need more information coming in. You can just go back and go through your past and reformulate all your existing memories. So that might lead to drugs like ketamine working more quickly. But that hasn't actually been tested in humans yet. And that's something that we're just about to start doing in our next project grant.
Do you see sort of a lot of barriers for that becoming a treatment in the clinic? These drugs can be quite controversial. I can imagine people are a bit hesitant to like send somebody home with a bunch of ketamine.
Yes. Oh, there's certainly a lot of complications. And yeah. I don't think anyone really thinks that ketamine is going to become a first line treatment for depression. It's really reserved for very refractory cases.
Right.
For the reasons that you say. I mean, actually, it is always administered, well, ketamine itself is administered IV in a hospital setting with an anaesthetist present, and it's also a street drug, so you have to be very careful, of course, about sending people home. There is a new version, esketamine, that is a nasal spray, but again, that's only administered in the clinic. So it's not going to be a very widely utilised strategy. But what it has done is give us hope that there are ways of affecting depression really quickly, and that if we knew exactly how ketamine was working, that we could find other ways of doing that same thing, perhaps without all these other complications that drugs like ketamine have got. So it's, yes, in itself, it's more a sort of idea stimulator than a problem solver, I think.
So another very new approach to treat conditions like depression is to use brain stimulation methods, and especially these non-invasive brain stimulation methods, because they're relatively easy to apply. How promising do you think are these methods in really making a clinical improvement for the condition?
Well, the data is quite interesting. I think that there's different ways of affecting the brain non-invasively. So with TMS, I think that there's quite a good evidence base that can be useful in depression. And I believe it is in the NICE guidelines, so it can be used. The other way is with TDCS, which is in a way, a more portable and easy way of affecting the brain. And there's some promising data in the area, but it hasn't been as tested as TMS. But I think it's a very possibly fruitful avenue, because there's so many different... The brain is so important, and we need ways of modulating it. And perhaps if we can do that, we could do it in a more direct way than a drug that will have effects across the whole brain, even if we might want to only affect one part of it. Mm-hmm. We can't give a drug to a specific area, but perhaps with things like TDCS or TMS, we can actually affect the circuits that are involved a bit more directly. So I think it's a useful strategy.
So now there are many parallel strategies, these electrical and magnetic stimulation methods, rapid acting antidepressants, the more conventional antidepressants such as serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Do you think there's a good way to combine them and to really make the treatment of depression more effective?
I think it's a really good question. I don't think there's been enough work on combination treatments, actually, altogether. I mean, there's different treatments, like psychological treatments also used and effective, and drug treatments, and then the stimulation and nutritional supplements, exercise, all of these things may have a role for the treatment of depression, but they tend to be examined in by specific groups who are very focused on that specific intervention. Mm-hmm. And I think what we need now is more work on how to combine them, and more use of frameworks and theory to guide that. So may not be that just giving two effective treatments together is any better than just one of them. In fact, some work suggests that if you combine psychological treatment and a drug, you can have poorer longer-term outcome than if you just had one. So we really need to understand what we're doing and what happens when you give the two together. But as a research question, that's much more complicated, because you need many more groups of participants. And you're also cutting across divisions that have been in the field for quite a long time. And it can be quite tricky to cut across those, although in a way I think that's what we're trying to do, is to pull those. We're not really pro drug or pro TMS or pro psychological treatment, we're just pro intervention, and we want to understand how they might work across however they might work and how to best use them together. So I think what we need is more research addressing that specific question.
So maybe one last question about this topic. As of 2019, what do you think is the most promising strategy for the upcoming years in developing new treatments for depression?
Well, I think the focus on the fast-acting antidepressants is perhaps the most promising area that we've had for a long time. I think that there is a lot of interest in trying to find the magic bullet of ketamine and packaging it in a more benign package. And I think that that probably will lead to some useful treatments in the future. The difficulty is knowing exactly how ketamine's working because it has so many effects in the brain. And attention has really, really focused on it as an NMDA antagonist. But that might not be the mechanism by which it's working. And so time will tell, but there has to be a sort of process of learning and trial and error and using that as the starting point to try and get to what I hope would be a better treatment. But I also think beyond that, there is a sort of broader perspective in depression than ever there has been before. And there's a realisation that people may become depressed through different routes, and that they may have, because of that, different targets that might be effective for treatment. So, for example, there's a focus on the role of inflammation in depression, and a subset of patients, particularly treatment-resistant depressed patients, have very high levels of inflammatory markers. And inflammation itself is something which can lead to the experience of depression. You know that if you're coming down with a cold or flu, you can feel really awful. And so that underneath can contribute to some cases of depression. And if that's true, then finding more targeted treatments for inflammation might be a strategy for that subgroup of patients that have mm-hmm. that particular characteristic. So I suppose more globally, what I'd see is the hope for the future is that we would actually pick apart the different reasons for depression, the different underlying things for different individuals that would enable us to target the treatment much more effectively. And that would then lead to better overall treatment, because for some people, SSRIs work really well, and for others, they don't really work at all. Mm. And so we need to know why.
So we're really getting into individualized treatment.
Yeah. Condition. Yeah. I think that is a key aim for our field.
Interesting. Yeah. From what you're saying, it sounds like there's a lot of stuff going on, right? There's like a lot of different approaches, a lot of different experimental approaches, a lot of different treatments that are being tested. But I do feel that sometimes psychiatry can get a lot of negative media attention. So people would say, when you look at the drugs that are actually available to you in the clinic when you have a depression, haven't changed very much in the past couple of decades. What's your view on that from inside the field?
Well, I think there is some truth in that, but it's not the whole truth. I mean, I think that the treatment of depression has got a bit more specific over the years, so we have treatments with fewer side effects than we used to, but in terms of the efficacy, they're not much different. But we've also got a much broader range of different treatments, and from an individual's perspective, that can be quite useful. So if you don't respond to one treatment, we have another one that we can try, and then we can have another one, whereas decades ago we wouldn't have had that choice. So I think it has progressed, but I do think that there has been a general problem in treatment development in psychiatry, and I think it's probably not only in psychiatry but across CNS. And I think that's partly because we don't really understand the brain as well as we might understand other systems in the body, and so there's been a very high failure rate of new treatments. But also I suppose that this, we have to be careful of stigma in the field, and the sort of criticism of psychiatry generally, I think, can feed into the belief somewhere in society that people shouldn't experience these kinds of mental health problems, and therefore we shouldn't treat them. And so we do have to be careful.
Right. Yeah.
And actually, some interesting work. We all have this idea that drugs and psychiatry don't work that well, but when you actually look at the data, they work pretty much as any other area of medicine. So we need progress in all areas of medicine. Psychiatry is one of them. But we have to be careful to kind of get over the stigma associated with psychiatry as well.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned this negative stigma of psychiatry. Yeah. And you've done a lot of public outreach. You're a very good communicator of science and support a lot of charities who try to make a change in this attitude towards depression and other mental health conditions. How far do you think has this already changed the attitude of society towards depression, and what else can be done?
I think it has changed a huge amount over the, even in the time that I've been in the field, and I think that people are more open about mental health problems, and the more open that people are, the more it becomes a topic of conversation, and it becomes less judged or considered negatively. So I think that is a big part of the progress in the field. I think that there's still a sort of stigma around treatment in these disorders. So people sometimes have very strong opinions about what they think is the appropriate treatment, and I think that's fine from your individual perspective. You can decide, you know, I really believe that I don't want to take an antidepressant. I really believe that I do, and I don't want to have counselling. Or, you know, I think that that's fine at an individual level when you're thinking about yourself. But I don't think that's fine when you apply it to other people. Like, you should be able to pull yourself together, or you just need some therapy, or you don't need treatment. You mustn't take a drug. And so I think the stigma comes, sort of filters through in different ways of thinking about it. Like all the media attention to antidepressants don't work, the drugs don't work, whereas actually they do work. But people don't want to think that they do, I think.
Is there like this sort of hesitance to think about it in like biological terms?
I think that's part of it, that I think, well, there's this still kind of mind-brain division, yeah, where not everything that you think, and as a human, of course, it's hard to think of yourself as a collection of neurons and neurotransmitters. But I think it's partly that, but it's partly that. And sometimes if you have a bad day or you have some stressful experience, you can get out of it yourself without any extra help. But you can't always. And I think it's the kind of human tendency to think, well, I managed to cope with that stress and I didn't need it, or somebody else might do. Right. And I think we just have to be more open to the possibility that there are different, we have a good range of different possible types, right, of treatment. We should be open to
people kind of impose their own experience on, yes, someone else,
because it's a very human experience, how we feel, how we cope with stress. We all have those experiences, yeah, whereas perhaps in other areas of medicine we don't all have the same experience as somebody with a different type of condition. Yeah. So I always think it's a bit like, you know, diabetes. To some extent, for some people you can manage that with your lifestyle, but sometimes you can't and you need insulin or another treatment. And I think depression's a bit like that. Sometimes you can manage it yourself, or you can find strategies that work for you, but you can't always. And then it's good that we have these other treatments that are available.
It's a very interesting comparison that we have different degrees of severity. Sometimes you can actually, yeah, manage it with lifestyle, and sometimes, yeah, you need some sort of biological treatment.
Yes, and it shouldn't be thought of as a failure, because you wouldn't think of it in that way in other areas, or you failed because you need a drug. It's not a failure, it's just a treatment. We should remove that stigma from accessing help, I think. And I think that's the next stage, not just being open about mental health, but also being open to evidence and open to treatments.
So are you optimistic about the future of psychiatry?
I am, actually. I think it seems an amazing time to be part of psychiatry research. I think the field has perhaps had quite a slow level of progress recently, but it really feels that things are changing all the time now. We've got such a lot of new techniques to look at the brain, we've got new treatments coming on board, we've got more focus on the individual and personalising treatment. It feels that we're on this brink of this step change, and I think many areas of medicine and science are like that you sort of bumble along, and then you can see it, for example, in prognosis for cancer treatment in other areas of medicine, that there's, you know, recovery rates are very low, and then something changes, some new treatment, some new way of conceptualizing, or some gene, and then it step changes. And I do feel that we're kind of on the brink of a massive change.
It's exciting.
Yeah, I think so.
So you obviously have a very good overview of the field as a professor here at Oxford and with long experience in the field. What piece of advice would you give to graduate students who might be interested in experimental psychology research or psychiatry research? What are the most interesting or valuable techniques to learn at the moment, the most interesting fields to go into?
I think it really depends very much on their interests, because there's so many different ways of approaching this question. I mean, I'm a more applied end than
than some, but not as applied as others who might actually be situated in the clinic and putting into place some evidence-based treatments more on the ward, for example. So I think the main thing is that it's so much of your life that you should find questions and a way of thinking that really interests you, and to get a kind of flavour of different approaches. Don't be put off because you never considered working with animals or you never considered working with patients, but perhaps try and get the opportunity to work across these different areas so you find something that really stimulates your interest. Go to talks and hear about different approaches, and I think that can be very, very useful. And I suppose sort of more generic advice is just to keep going. It's easy to get demoralised at different ways along through a PhD, after a PhD, on the way to a professorship, and sometimes it seems like a difficult road, and that perhaps I hear many people saying, well, I'm just not sure if I'm good enough to do it. And to be honest, that's how I felt and still feel many many days, like, oh, I don't know if I can do it, I don't know if I should really be here. But everyone feels like that, I think, and so it's just to have kind of confidence and to try and keep going and to not let that put you off.
That's very encouraging.
Yeah.
And now I know from previous interviews that you've given your very broad interests. What are other fields outside of neuroscience or maybe medicine that you find very stimulating?
Yeah, I have to say that outside of work, I wouldn't call myself very academically minded. I think I just intended to completely switch off. Although I like reading and fiction and novels and
that sounds healthy,
films and things like that. And yeah, I guess in terms of how I fill my time, I'm training for half marathon at the moment.
Wow.
So that should take more of my time than it does. So hopefully I manage to get around it. And other, like, you know, keeping fit generally. And dancing, I noticed on your list. Yes,
yeah, I do we like were informed that you occasionally dabble in street dance.
I do. Well, yes, dabbling is probably a good term. Yes, I've dragged some of my colleagues off to a street dance class for almost a year. But during that time, we realised that actually we weren't getting any better. And we were still as bad at street dancing as when we started. So it's lapsed a bit. But that was a really fun, activity. Yeah. So I've got 3 kids as well. They keep me pretty busy with activities. And so we do a lot of fun things together. And that's a pretty good way of blocking out what might be on your mind from work, that you're so busy kayaking or playing football or going on bike rides that you don't really notice. So, but yes, I think if I was giving advice to myself as a graduate student, I would say stop working and do a bit more, like, do a bit more exercise or a bit more, try and have a more rounded life.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for giving us so many insights into your work, but also your personal life. And I hope this will encourage many students like us to really keep working in this interesting field.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Cortex Cast. If so, please subscribe to the podcast or leave a comment. Your hosts for this episode were Alex von Klemperer, Lucas Corona, and myself. The theme music is by Eves Blue. If you'd like to find out more about Cortex Club, go to cortexclub.com. Thanks for listening.